As you know, I take delight in the byways and the strange detours of our Jewish history. And I'd like to rejoice with you in some of these this morning. I'd like to ask a question which seems self-evident on the surface. But like so much else in our history, the answer is not quite what we take it to be. The question is simple enough. Why do we light these lights of Hanukkah? And you know the answer. In the year 168 before the Common Era, the great Greek-Syrian Empire of the Seleucids proscribed Judaism, defiled the sacred temple in Jerusalem by setting up there an idol, Zeus Olympios, sacrificing to that idol. And the great traditional rites of our people were prohibited, the Sabbath, the teaching of Torah, circumcision. And this repression stimulated a rebellion led by Judah and his brothers. And after 3 years, they were successful in capturing Jerusalem from the Seleucids. And they cleansed the polluted sanctuary. And they reestablished there the cult. To celebrate the rededication, Chanukat HaBayit, they had the first Chanukah, the first festival day. And associated with that festival day, there was a miracle. The miracle of that little cruse of clarified oil, which had somehow escaped the destruction of the Seleucids, which was still sealed by the certification of the priests, appropriate for the holy lights of the sanctuary. But this little bit of oil was only sufficient in body for one day. Yet it lasted for 8 days until the priests who were associated with Judah were able to prepare more oil fit for the lights. Now this explanation of Chanukah derives from the Talmud. In the tractate known as Shabbat, the rabbis asked, "My Chanukah, why is Chanukah?" And this is their answer. The Greeks entered the temple. They defiled the oil therein. And when the Hasmonean dynasty prevailed against them and defeated them, they searched and found a sole cruse of oil, which had been authorized by the seal of the high priest. It contained sufficient oil for one day's lighting only. Yet a miracle happened, and they lit the lamps throughout the 8 days. And from the Talmud to our times, this has been the familiar and the accepted explanation of these lights. Now I shudder to think of how many simple sermons will be preached this holiday season, how many connections will be made between the problem of oil supply in those days and in this. And I suspect that the incurably optimistic among us will take the prayer literally. Just as God performed miracles in those days, so we will perform miracles in these, and someone will take hope out of the fact that these lights burn in memory of a miracle which solved an oil crisis 2,100 years ago. But I warn you, miracles don't come in such grandiloquent packages. All God did 2,100 years ago was to provide a pint of oil fit for the lights. That's all he needed. Today we consume, what, some tens of millions of gallons of oil every day that we are in shortfall of, which we lack. It would be unwise, I suspect, to draw an analogy when none, in fact, exists. Our tradition warns us against depending upon miracles. Talmud tells us, "Lulam lo yamod adam b'makom sakana," that no man stand ever in a place of danger, v'yomar, and saying, "Sharna yaseh li nes," that God will perform a miracle for me. He'll get me out of this danger. That's why I can take the dangerous plunge. Shema lo yaseh lo nes, lest God not perform the miracle. The miracle of Hanukkah will not be repeated. The miracle of the miraculous solution to our problems of oils depends upon tightening our belts and turning down our thermostats and driving our cars less and having cars which consume less gasoline. And ultimately, they depend upon our being willing to give of our substance and of our best minds to finding sources of energy, which ultimately will not be in short supply, particularly the natural energy of the sun. But be that as it may, here are the lights. They burn. Why do they burn, and what do they say? Now, I don't very often take issue with the Talmud. The more I've studied it over the years, the more I've been impressed with its wisdom. And yet here the Talmud is simply not factual. And it suggests that by the very presence of the question, "My Hanukkah," the Talmud is not a book of literature. It's a shorthand record of the discussions which were held in graduate school seminars by the rabbis in Jerusalem, in the Galilee, and in Babylon in the first, second, third, fourth, fifth centuries of the Common Era. And if the rabbis ask a question which is fit for a Sunday school class and not for a graduate school, why these lights, you know, either they want to make a very special point or they simply don't know. They're searching for tradition. They're searching for some explanation. Actually, the paragraph that I read you is a baraita, a statement by a sage, a Tana, in the late 2nd or early 3rd centuries of the Common Era, at least 400 years after the event, after the first Hanukkah celebration. And in all probability, it was meant in all innocence. He didn't know why the lights were actually being lit. For interestingly, when we review the literature between his day and the first Hanukkah over that 400-year period, we find that no one explains the lights of Hanukkah, the 8 lights, on the basis of the well-known miracle of the cruse of oil. Josephus, our own special Benedict Arnold, turned historian, who wrote late in the 1st century of our era, knew about the Hasmonean victory, knew that Hanukkah was called a festival of lights, but he didn't know why. It was simply a tradition which he had received. And if we go to the very beginning of our period, to the very first chronicle which explains Hanukkah, a book which was written perhaps a generation, maybe two, after the event, late in the 2nd century before the Common Era, around the year 125 or 130 BCE, we find there that the first Hanukkah is described without any reference to this famous legend. This particular volume, I read to you part of it this morning, 1st Maccabees, was written by a court historian associated with the Hasmoneans. That is, an historian who was patronized by the court of the descendants of Judah the Maccabee, who ruled an independent Israel for about 80 or 90 years between the Maccabean revolt and the arrival of Rome on the Middle Eastern scene. He was writing the chronicles of a dynasty, and he certainly had access to their records and to their archives. And when he describes the first Hanukkah, he describes it in this vein. When Judah had defeated the troops of the Greeks and re-entered Jerusalem, he and his troops came to the sanctuary, and they were aghast at what they saw. The despoilation, the destruction, the dirt, the filth, the idol, the desecrated altar. And they proclaimed a period of mourning. And they sat in sackcloth and ashes, the old way of showing that one was in mourning, and they recited lamentations. And then Judah decided to have a great festival of dedication, Chanukat Habayit, on the very same day, some months hence, which would be the anniversary of the day on which Antiochus and his men had polluted the sanctuary. Somehow the festival of rededication on that day would erase the act of having despoiled the sanctuary 3 years before. And having made that decision, he needed to know what must be done. Well, first of all, obviously, the sanctuary had to be put in order. The great altar on which the sacrifices to the idols had taken place had to be pulled down stone by stone and a new altar built. And the Greeks had taken all of the golden and silver utensils of the temple, the great lampstand, the menorah, the place for the showbread, where each of the tribes brought a loaf of bread as a thanks offering to God every day, the incense and the like. And these had to be recast and remade, for they had been simply, the precious metal had been burnt down and reduced to bars of gold, to booty by the Greeks. Having made those decisions, having made those changes, having refashioned, refurbished, purified the sanctuary, how was he to celebrate this great festival? Well, obviously, Judah had among his army priests and sages, pious people. This was a great revolt by the traditionists, by the believers. They knew their traditions. And they recalled that when Solomon had built the first temple, he had celebrated a great Chanukat Habayit, a great service of dedication, for 7 days. But he had actually built the walls and built the halls. And the walls and the bricks and the halls all were still in place. It was simply that they were despoiled. And they recall that in the 7th century before the Common Era, a king of Judah by the name of Hezekiah had decided that the temple needed to be cleansed, that God was punishing his people. The little country of Judea during Hezekiah's day was being attacked by the Babylonians and being defeated here and there and everywhere. And Hezekiah understood these attacks and these defeats to be the result of the sins of his father and his grandfather, who had allowed their foreign queens to establish their idols and their foreign cults within the boundary, within the gates of the sanctuary. And so he, like Judah 500 years later, had proclaimed a great day of reconsecration. He'd sent in the carpenters to refurbish. He'd sent in the washermen and the washerwomen to cleanse and to purify. And the temple had been aspersed and it had been cleansed, and they had celebrated a great Chanukat Habayit, a great festival of rededication, for 8 days. And they had begun it with the lighting of the great menorah, the great golden seven-branched candelabra, which is the basic symbol of the temple. And then there had been sacrifices. And each day there had been a great procession led by the Levites, playing the cymbal and the lyre and the harp and all the instruments of the day. And it was that celebration which Judah copied for his Chanukat Habayit, for his festival of rededication. The 8 days of Hanukkah correspond, in other words, not to a miracle of oil, but they correspond to a practice associated with the reconsecration of the temple sanctuary. It testifies to the interest of Judah and of his troops in what the temple meant. its place in the cult, in the faith, in the theology, in the redemptive hope of his people. And the lights that were lit that first Hanukkah were not these lights, eight light for 8 days with an extra light from which to light all the other tapers. What they lit was the great golden menorah, seven branches sitting on a round pedestal coming off a single central spine, the spine having three symmetrically rising arms, the whole, the top being parallel to the base, seven lights corresponding to the 7 days of the week. The six lights on the branches, the 6 days of labor, the light on the central spine, the seventh day, the day of rest. The menorah, the seven-branch candelabra, had become by this time the symbol of the temple and of all that the temple represents. It's the oldest, most classic, most significant symbol of Judaism. Recently in Jerusalem, about 2 years ago, Dr. Avigad, digging to the north and the east of the Haram, of the temple compound in a settlement from the time of King Herod, the first century before the Common Era, found a large piece of plaster from the inside of a home. And on that plaster, some workmen had incised this menorah, the seven branches, the base, exactly as the menorah must have been in the great temple just a few hundred yards further to the south. And that's the oldest symbolic representation we have of any ritual object, of any traditional object in our people, of our people. You find it again in the great arch of Titus in Rome, among the booty being taken by the Roman legions after the destruction of the temple in 70. You find the menorah as a symbol of the temple in almost all those figured mosaic floors from the sanctuaries of the synagogues, the second and third and fourth century, which have been uncovered in Israel. You find it on the coins which were minted by Bar Kokhba during his rebellion. Again and again and again, the menorah is the symbol of the temple. Solomon had built the first menorah. By tradition, when the Babylonians had destroyed the first temple in 587 before the Common Era, the priests had hid the temple, had hid the menorah. And when, in the end, Cyrus, in the end of that century, allowed the Jews to reestablish a sanctuary, it had been put back in its place. In all probability, it had been taken into Babylon with all the other sacred objects, and people remembered the shape and remembered the lights and associated the shape and the lights with all that was significant in their faith. 6 days of labor, the seventh day of rest. The six decades of life, the seventh decade, the time of rest, and then of eternal rest. The symmetry of the menorah represented the symmetry of the world. On the arms, as they rose up to hold up the tapers, there were figures of flowers, florets, kaftor ferach, they're called in the tradition. They represented the planets. They represented the vision that men had of that day of the orderliness of the universe, God's control of an orderly universe. It represented, the light represented that all was well between God and between Israel, because it was lit every day in the sanctuary. The redemptive apparatus of the tradition, of the cult, was somehow in operation when the lights, when these lights were lit. Light is learning, Torah, Ora, for the commandment is a light and the teaching is a lamp. Light is learning, light is the light of faith, light is the promise of redemption. The menorah itself was called a tree of life, an Eitz Chaim. It was the tree which promised eternal life, the trunk, the boughs, the light, rising Godward, the symbol of the temple. And it was this menorah that was lit, relit, rekindled, 2,100 years ago during the Chanukat Habayit, the Chanukah celebration of the Maccabees. And the emphasis that day must have been on the temple, on the cult, on the sacrificial cult, and all that it represented in our tradition. Why then these lights? Why this kind of menorah? Like every holiday, like every historical event, like every symbol, there are a whole congeries of meanings which one associates with a particular event. That victory of Judah was not simply a cleansing of the temple, a reopening of the redemptive apparatus of the tradition, but it was also the day of the founding of the Hasmonean dynasty. It was that day that Judah proclaimed himself viceroy, governor of Judea. It was on that day, 20 years later, that his son and then his grandson proclaimed themselves high priests and kings in Judah. For the 80 years that the Hasmoneans ruled a sovereign and independent Jewish state, Hanukkah was July 4th. It was the day of independence. It was a great day of dynastic celebration. For we must remember that within the story there is not only piety and faith, but there's political ambition and political intrigue. What is Hanukkah? In the 4th century, before the Common Era, Alexander the Great, that young, brilliant hero, military genius, the avaricious and greedy conqueror, took his Macedonian and Greek troops across all of Asia Minor. He conquered the world, so they said. And when he died in his early 30s, his empire was divided between his generals. One named Ptolemy became emperor in Egypt. One named Seleucus became emperor in Syria. For the first century of their rule, the Egyptian generals and kings were more powerful than the Syrian generals and kings. But around the year 200, 198 before the Common Era, the balance of power tended to go towards the Seleucids, those who ruled in Egypt. It was a time of Hellenization, when Greek ideas and Greek values began to permeate throughout that part of the world. It was an abundant time, an affluent time, a time of urbanization and of greater international trade. A new class arose, a class of international merchants who wanted to be able to speak, who needed to speak a similar tongue, who needed to have a similar form of contract from city-state to city-state in order to do business. And the system arose in that empire of having within each city or poli certain forms, educational, athletic, cultural, which gave a Greek-like stamp to the Syrian or the Judean or the Egyptian natives who were now coming into positions of establishment and of authority. In order to qualify, one had to have these Greek institutions. And what were they? One was called an Ephebium. It was a private school. It was a place in which the distinctive stamp of language and of learning, which was appropriate to the Greek world, was given to the youth. One was the gymnasium, the place in which the young Greeks were trained for athletics, for sports, in which their bodies were honed into that sense of beauty which was so important to the Greek world. Now, in Jerusalem, a backward provincial capital way up in the Judean hills, these Greek ideas came late, but they came nevertheless. And there was in Jerusalem a party of Hellenizers, of the rich, of the few, of the privileged, who wanted to become a poli, who wanted to have all the advantages of dealing with those like themselves in Antioch and Tyre and Alexandria and Athens. And they tried to bring into Jerusalem Greek forms and Greek institutions. Now we tend to think of Greeks and associated with high culture. And there was much that was wonderful in Greek philosophy and Greek science. But Greek morality was often another thing. To the Jew, the family was sacred. To the Greek, homosexuality was taken for granted. To the Jew, modesty in dress and modesty in form was quintessential. To the Greek, being naked in one's games was taken for granted. The Jew was bidden by God, thou shalt not murder. The Greek accepted the exposure of children, something which was quite natural to limit population. Again and again, Greek values and the traditional Hebraic values were in conflict. To the Jew, every man was created in the image of God. To the Greek, even to Aristotle, the slave was nothing more than a living tool. And those who were not Greek were barbarians, barbaros, apes. There were fundamental divergences in values between these two traditions. But Greece was the imperial tradition. Greece offered prosperity. Greece offered a breaking out of one's parochial, one's narrow, one's provincial life. And there were those who were eager for it. And as they tried to establish games and the Ephebium and all of these Greek institutions in Jerusalem, the privileged few ran into the teeth of the anger of the traditionalist, of the conservative, of the pious, of the believer. And there was tension, and there were riots of all kinds. And in the middle of this incipient civil war, Antiochus IV, the Seleucid emperor, became ambitious. He sensed the weakness of the Ptolemy, who was ruled in Alexandria, and he sent his armies against Alexandria. And he had two successful campaigns, and he was about to complete the destruction of Alexandria, which would have given him mastery over all of Egypt, when suddenly the ambassador of Rome, the new power, appeared before in his camp, a man named Caius Popillius. And this man handed to Antiochus at the very moment of his victory an ultimatum: either pull back, return home, or Rome will make war with you. And Antiochus asked for time. He asked for a Geneva conference, but none was allowed him. The ambassador took his staff of office and drew a circle in the sand around the emperor's feet and said, Rome demands an answer before you step out of this circle. I don't know what went through Antiochus's mind at the time. He weighed the odds, decided the odds were against him, and he retreated. He returned to Antioch. He returned an angry man. And this emperor, who had been so ambitious, so imperial in his vision, suddenly developed a siege mentality. He was concerned about his frontier. He was concerned about disloyalty. He demanded a loyalty oath of all of his citizens, particularly those in the frontier provinces like Judea, Jerusalem. And what was that loyalty oath? That they, everyone, offer a sacrifice to Zeus Olympius, the patron god of the Seleucids. This was relatively easy for most of the people to do because they had many gods. One more, one less meant very little. But the Jew was bound to the second commandment: thou shalt not make unto thee any graven images, nor any manner of likeness. Thou shalt not bow down to them, nor serve them. And many Jews refused to offer this loyalty oath. In anger, this besieged emperor turned viciously against Jerusalem. He knew about the civil war, the chaos which was there in any case. He didn't have time or interest in dealing with this benighted little people, the Judeans. So he told his army to go in and stamp out the rebellion and see to it that those who were loyal were put in power and everybody else was done away with. And as is the way with the tyrants who simply try to impose their will, you kill many, but you ultimately can't kill the spark of resistance. There's always a Mattathias, there's always a Judah, there are always those who will take to the mountains and fight the fight of the few against the many. In this case, the few ultimately defeated the many. And we have the lights of Hanukkah. Hanukkah then is both a religious moment and a dynastic moment. And the lights of Hanukkah were associated with both a religious and a secular, if you will, kind of triumph. But the Maccabees were to rule for a brief 80 years. And then Rome put the puppets of Antipater and Herod on the throne, and ultimately her own procurators. Ask yourselves what would happen to the 4th of July here in these United States if the People's Republic of China or the Union of Socialist Soviet Republics were suddenly to control this country, to police it. Obviously, they would have no patience with the 4th of July. And equally obviously, those who wanted freedom would find some way to demonstrate. Or at the very least, they would meet surreptitiously, clandestinely, and plan revolt. Antipater and Herod, these half-Jews who ruled in the first century, soon did away with Hanukkah because of its dynastic connections with those whose power they had usurped. And then when Rome came with her iron boot and crushed all Jewish self-rule, then it became dangerous for Jews to plot revolt against their own puppets. In 66 and 70, the plotters, the zealots, had their revolt. And the result was the destruction of the temple. The revolt was lost at a cost of 1 million lives. And not many decades later, the zealots, the hotheads, had another revolt associated with Bar Kokhba and Matzada. And again, there was utter destruction. And again, over 1 million lives were lost. And Matzada stands today as a monument to suicidal bravery. The dynastic holiday, Hanukkah, could no longer obviously be celebrated. It was proscribed. And in time, even the rabbis, the sages, began to fear that the message of Hanukkah, the few can defeat the many, was a message that could not be supported by a defeated people. It encouraged them to try again and again for their freedom, to attempt with suicidal bravery to establish again their sovereignty. And every time they made the attempt, the punishment was wicked, fearsome. And somehow in those centuries, the liturgy and the lore of Hanukkah developed into its present form. As we light the lights, what do we say? We say the traditional blessing, who has sanctified us by his commandments and commanded us to kindle the Hanukkah lights, the same blessing we say with the Sabbath lights or holiday lights. That's to be expected. And then we add a special blessing to the God who performed miracles in those days as in our own. The attempt was to underscore that the victory of the few over the many is the victory not of the Maccabees, but of God himself. And the liturgy developed and refined and honed clear this message that none might mistake it. Al Hanisim, for the miracles, Al Haniflaot, and for the wonders, and for Al Hatshuot, and for the redemptive acts, Al Hamilchamot, and because of the wars which you, O Lord our God, fought on our behalf, we thank you. That's the liturgy of Hanukkah. It's one which emphasizes the divine miracle rather than the sword of man, the Maccabean achievement. It was an attempt to tell the people to be patient, to have faith, to trust in God, and not simply to trust in the strength of their right hand or the courage of their hearts. And one can see in those centuries how Hanukkah was celebrated with story, and how some teacher to his class or some rabbi to his disciples told a story associated with the 8 days in which he related it to a cruse of oil, a divine miracle, again to drive home the point that no one would misunderstand that Hanukkah stands as the triumph of God over the forces of the ungodly, not the triumph of man over the forces of evil. Now, I hesitate to draw any contemporary conclusions from all of this, because like all else in Jewish history, we end with paradox. We lack the clarity that we think we have. Obviously, if it hadn't been for the courage of the Maccabees, we would not have Hanukkah. If they had not been willing to put their lives on the line, to use the vernacular, the Syrians would have remained in power, the temple would have remained despoiled, the Hellenizing Jews would have asserted power, and Judaism would have been perverted 200 years before the Common Era from the course that it ultimately accepted to remain faithful to the law of God. The Battle of the Maccabees was a battle for religious freedom. It might not have been, it certainly would not have been successful had men not been willing to struggle and to die. But having achieved that victory, the problem is not solved. Life remains uncertain. There is the moment of exaltation, then there is attack by other forces, other enemies. There are other moments of uncertainty, insecurity. Ultimately, the Hasmonean dynasty disappears. I've often wondered at the penchant of many in modern Israel to ascribe to themselves the term Maccabee. They're the Maccabean games. Israelis often speak of the Maccabean spirit. At Hanukkah, the young people who are just being inducted into the army have a race from Modi'in, the 17 miles into Jerusalem. Now, the sense of courage, the willingness to die for freedom, has certainly been all, in one sense, that has sustained this little state for 26 years. But there's danger in believing that by the might of arms alone, by courage alone, security can be won. And after the events of this fall and this winter, I don't have to belabor that point. You need the Maccabean spirit. But you need to have that spirit with a certain humility, a certain recognition that you need the cruse of oil, the miracle, the sustaining right hand of God. And how have Jews traditionally believed that they merited this miracle? By squaring their accounts with God, by living in such a way that the community reflects the light of learning, the light of concern, the light of social or divine conscience. The strength of Israel, modern Israel, will depend upon the Maccabean spirit of its young heroes and upon the social convictions of its citizens, upon their ability to weld a state in which there are no extremes of wealth, of poverty, of learning, of ignorance, of privilege, and of lack of privilege, in which the differences between Westerner and Easterner, old immigrant and new immigrant, somehow disappear. And what is true of the land of Israel is true of us, who are part of the congregation of Israel. Our survival depends not only on our willingness to stand up for our rights and our people in Israel and the Soviet Union, our own poor here, but it depends on our having in our hearts all that menorah stood for. Faith, learning, God's redemptive power. And what is true of the land of Israel and of the people of Israel is true of all mankind, is it not? Ultimately, courage is a relatively cheap commodity. Vision is a relatively rare commodity. And understanding vision welded to a high faith is rarer still. And if these lights have any meaning, I would hope that they remind us of the many varied demands made on us by life. Hasmonean courage, traditional vision, concern for all the pure virtues that this light represents, and a quiet confidence that ultimately this light will burn despite the darkness, that whatever be the shadows surround us, God's redemptive power remains strong, visible,